Welcome to CBAW Loves, a book club podcast from Community Building Artworks. I'm Seema Reza.
And I'm Amelia Bain. Each episode, Seema and I will invite a rotating cast of fellow writers and artists to discuss a book that we love.
We hope you'll read along and join the conversation.
Welcome back to CBAW Loves. I'm Amelia Bain.
And I'm Seema Reza.
Seema, you chose, or you suggested the book for this month. Can you tell me why you chose it and what the book is?
So we had been talking about a book that really grapples with belonging. I think that's what we were sort of looking for this summer. And I came across this book, In the Shelter, by Padraig O'Tooma, who, of course, is a poet and thinker who so many of us here admire. And I was really, really, you know, moved by how he deals with this experience of wanting to belong in a faith that he wasn't sure had space for the whole of who he was. And of course, that's like, that's one particular experience being a queer person in a Christian religious tradition. But I also think of there's so many places where we belong in some amount, and then in other degrees feel deeply outside of. And I think that's actually part of the experience of belonging, is that it's always incomplete. It's always a grappling. So I was really excited to read this book and talk about it with writers I love.
One of our team members, Ben Weekly, when we mentioned what the book was, said, "Can I come?" So he joined us for a conversation with Amber Flame, who, if you're a listener of the podcast, you know from several episodes, is one of our favorites. We love always hearing what Amber has to say.
I was so bummed to miss it. I'm having some ongoing health issues and had, you know, when you get an appointment, you go to it when it's doctors. but I'm really, really fascinated to hear, of course, what Amber and Ben and you think of it, but also if there are any readers who weren't raised in the Christian tradition, like myself, who read the book, how their experience of the book may have differed by that, like, sort of degree of separation.
Well, we certainly missed you, Seema. We really missed you, but we had a great conversation. So here is my conversation with Ben Weekly and Amber Flame.
I'm Amber Flame. I am a interdisciplinary artist and also an arts administrator. I work for Hedgebrook, which is an elite residency for women-identified folk on Whidbey Island in Washington State, and I'm the program director there, and an alum and a writer, among other things. And I think for the purpose of this podcast, I'm also was raised in a fundamentalist Christian church, and I'm gay. So I felt an affinity to this book in particular, and I'm glad to be a part of the podcast.
So I'm Ben Weekly. I am a 14-year Army veteran. I spent time in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Pentagon. Retired a few years ago, and I'm now a poet, an author. And I'm the director of development for Community Building Artworks. And I was raised in the Methodist Church, so kind of mainstream Protestant Christian, which is how I came into this book, and found that kind of an interesting entry point into the book. Because Protestantism versus Catholicism, the author has a lot to say, not just about Christianity, but Catholic upbringing, and a lot of the questions, and kind of conflicts, I guess, that come into that. So I found it really interesting with my faith background, and kind of how that played out as an adult for me as well.
Yeah, I guess I'll just share my background as well. I'm Amelia. I grew up in the South in a Baptist church, but I was not Southern Baptist. So it's a little less You know, we had like women clergy. There were some gay people in our congregation, quietly gay people in our congregation. But I found this book an incredible read. I think it's one that I'm going to need to revisit. I'm going to need to like return to this book to figure out how I feel about it again and again. I related a lot to the storytelling of his queerness. I'm also a queer person, and how that story changes over time and continues. It needs to continue to be rewritten and re-understood. And Ben, I know you were familiar with Padre Gotuama's work before, because when we announced that this was the book we were going to read, you said, "Can I come?" or something like that. You were like, "Can I be in this episode?" Where did that come from? Like, what's your background with this writer?
So originally, in fairness, I just asked to lurk and not make you all suffer listening to my voice and my thoughts. And I am familiar with him and his work as less of a religious thinker and more of a like conflict thinker. So, you know, like mediator of opposing sides, and kind of have read about the work he has done in the Corrymeela community, kind of bringing the Protestant and Catholic voices together in Northern Ireland, and I'm fascinated by, you know, just given my background and some of the things that places I've been, things I've seen and been in the middle of, I'm fascinated by people who can bring together such divergent backgrounds, not opinions, not voices, not perspectives, but like identities, right, that are so opposed across conflict, and be able to hold them in community together. And so that's my fascination with his story and his kind of thinking and work. And that actually kind of only deepened as I read the book. It was interesting. It's sort of like, I felt like he really, in the shelter, he kind of opens up the hood and you see sort of the spiritual guts behind like where that comes from, where his ability to do that, to see people who, so for instance, like to see people who see his queerness as unacceptable, or, you know, in the context of church, unholy, or, you know, wrong, and still be able to hold dialogue with them. And that's fascinating to me.
You know, I spend most of my time reading, like I said, fiction, usually by Black women. and so especially like lately, just fiction and essays by Black people. And so I was like, and then Seema was like, "I really want to hear your perspective on this." And I was like, and it's interesting because what you said, Amelia, about it being something to return to and like unpack different layers of, it very much reads like scripture, like a psalm. There's often these sort of like blessed bees, these beatitudes, you know, throughout it. And that was really appealing. But as you were talking, Ben, I was thinking like, I bet he's a Libra, or like I was trying to figure out the birthday. I was like looking him up to see if I could figure out his birthday, because it's just such a, like, yeah, what you were saying, Ben, the conflict mediation, the untangling, the, like, you know, like perceiving it as this like sort of knot to like gently pick at and untangle, is clear. Like it started with himself, and this sort of like I love this, the idea of little tiny, you know, 3-4-year-old super zealous religious Parik going to church, you know, and like wanting a Bible for Christmas, and, you know, like when you get the calling, I think that was what was really beautiful about it, is that it wasn't a calling to be a priest or to be, it was instead this calling to words. And as soon as he made peace with himself about his own inclinations of whatever they were, that was like the first conflict to resolve. And he's like, if I can bring these opposing things together inside myself, then I can do this with anybody. And yeah, I found I found it really, really clear that, I mean, it was very, it was like the Bodhisattva in Buddhism, where it's like, your job is to like lead other people toward enlightenment, right? And so not through, he just poses a lot of questions, not through answers. Like he doesn't give, he's not like, and here's the answer. He's like, this kid told me, he said an interesting thing when I asked him to imagine Jesus. And, you know, it's like, and you just kind of are left to draw, you know, your own moral from the parable kind of thing. My mom, years ago now, her dissertation was on, she was a philosopher of language. And so we grew up with these kind of like quandaries of, you know, do, when I say something, do you mean what I say? Do you understand what I mean? When I say these words, do they mean the same thing to you? And no, in brief, and that's what he gets to. He's like, no, are we saying the same thing? Are we even talking the same language? Most of the time, not. But he does it in such like gorgeous word nerdery.
That moment very early where he brings up the peace be with you, that like that blew my mind, because that's, we take for granted that that means one thing when it actually was just like hello. Like it was just a greeting in that right. In that setting,
and yet it's all right. Loaded, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, somebody decided to put it in that book, so it's all loaded, right?
Right. I love his drawing out, you know, his drawing out of Christ in several parts of the book, mm-hmm. You know, reaching back to different either parables or, you know, stories where he's, you know, juxtaposing a, like a non-disciple character, right? A, you know, he's like, remember, like, it's not always just what we're saying in the gospel about Jesus. It's about, you know, the lady at the well, mm-hmm. or it's about, you know, the Samaritan on the side of the road, right? And what do those people say about Jesus, you know, in the story that's being told? And I love too how he juxtaposes. I think there's one part towards the end where he's talking about the order of the not the gospel, the order of the New Testament. Mm. I wish it were flipped, you know, so you had all the like the epistles and like the, you know, here's the old dudes writing, you know, academic kind of like rule setting, like yeah. This is a bunch of thought. About Jesus, and then like, okay, let's end on the story, because the stories are what like illuminates the truth. And I thought that was really interesting too, because there is a difference, I think, to me, there's like the Christianity, which is the rules and the ritual and the epistles, right? Like the Paul sitting down and saying this is what you should do and not do, and then the Christ, which is like the story that mm-hmm. illuminates and like doesn't have all the answers but has truth that you can get to if you keep digging, that's not necessarily the exclusive truth but is truth nonetheless.
It's not necessarily exclusive truth. You keep reminding me of like one of my favorite lines in the book is the moment he realizes that not all Christians believe Christians are Christians.
Yes.
That was so great. Not all Christians believe Christians yeah. are Christians. Believe all Christians are Christians or something like that. And it was yep. just
yeah.
like, yes, that's what it comes down to, right? Is like this sort of, I love this idea of the rule setting. I also love that he juxtaposes what is it? The hermeneutics of the Bible. Like he juxtaposes, like, remember, this had hundreds of years to be edited. We don't know how deep these edits go, and we don't know to whose intention or when or where or why. So just like to read into what words were chosen and why, and imagine then what was edited out and by whom. And so, and I love that very quickly he stops referring it to as like the one that's attributed to Luke or attributed to Mark instead of, you know, whoever wrote this. Like this sort of broadening our understanding of like the gospel truth, and the juxtaposition of that with like, I love the exercise of putting his students or his participants or whatever into the stories, like having them enter the stories in their imagination and like discovering what role they are inclined to take, like the one who stood in the corner and watched with jealousy as this woman, you know, like was overcome, was hysterical, right? Who was breaking expensive oils and crying on Jesus's feet, you know, like, you know, and to like recognize the jealousy. I was like, I'm going to try that exercise myself. Like, how do you insert yourself? Where do you insert yourself? And how, like, who do you see yourself reflected as in these stories? To put it as that question back to us instead of, here's what this story is supposed to tell us. There's no prescriptive, here's what the story is supposed to tell us. It's like, perhaps it's a story of this. Hello, goodness, you know, hello, this, you know, and that that sort of lingering ellipses of questions woven throughout every one of these juxtapositions is really, it makes you work. It's I couldn't speed read through the book. I really thought I was just going to be able to like pound this book. And I was like, and this is, I'm going to have to, I kept rereading phrases. I drifted off to it. It was like the Bible in that way, you know, it's a good way to get yourself put to sleep. Just read the Bible a little bit, especially the Begats section. If you really want to knock yourself out. But yeah, there was something really like, it was a workbook. It's a workbook. It makes the reader work and consider the questions that he's posing and talking about and telling a story of, I should say, not talking about, but exhibiting in a story of his life or Jesus's life or the, you know, or something from the Gospels or his students or somebody, a friend of his. Like it's so multivaried where the parable will pull from. That you have to catch yourself. Like I'm working. I'm like really thinking about and incorporating this.
Yeah, I found myself speeding through a bit and then thinking back to the beginning of the book where he's like, "Hello to here, slow down, like be here." And I was like, "Okay, should I really be speeding through this book?" Because I think you're right, Amber. It is like it requires something of you. It's like there's some give and take to it to read it.
What I love, that's such a good point. And I think what I love about the book and what I love about the style, right, of questioning is I think like that is kind of like the act of like practicing faith at its best to me, like whatever that faith is, whether, you know, whether it's like a secular thing or Christianity or Judaism or whatever it is, right? It probably should kind of like disturb us, right? Mm-hmm. Probably should be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there's this moment in the book that like I had to go back to a couple times, and like he's literally going through the story of Judas and making you the reader go like, okay, on the one hand, this is the person that like Christendom for, you know, two millennia has, you know, pointed at as this is the betrayer of
an archetype.
Yeah, this is the archetype of like a kind of sin and evil, right? But also like what would you do, and like how many ways could you put yourself in that position and just wind up doing the same thing, doing the best you can to get by? And I always come back to like, Because so I mean my cards on the table. I am still like a practicing Christian. I still go to church, and sometimes it's very easy in like the little Bible studies or the Sunday school class and everything to go, okay, well, here in the context of this, like we're like Paul, or we're like Simon, or we're like we're like the
Good
Samaritan.
guess.
Which one of the But like I kind of always am uneasy thinking, like looking around my life Monday through Saturday, and like, folks, we're Rome. Like, I mean,
Full-on
looking
empire.
around, like,
It's like
I,
wasting time now.
Oh, Ben. You're right.
we're not the
Guys,
guys, look where you go to work, look where you go
maybe
to.
Babylon, but
Yeah, we're Rome, we're Babylon, we're not the. And so to yeah, I love that line of thought that's like, if you can pause and figure out like, where am I not the good guy in this story? Maybe that's useful, a useful bit of spirituality for any of us, you know?
Yeah. I had not heard the interpretation of Judas as like a revolutionary who knew that like revolution needed a villain or needed like
A
Christ to be
hero.
like, yeah. And so I wasn't familiar with that idea. And it just made me think of all of the people that are misguided in their actions, right? Who are doing things with conviction that are like, and myself included, right? Like thinking that we're making the right decisions. Like Ben said, when you put yourself in the shoes of, the more flawed or more human characters in the Bible, like, yeah, I think it is more, there's more opportunity to understand yourself better when you're comparing yourself to someone who's human.
I think also there's like the true facts of how many of us know that we're in a moment of history when it's happening, and how much of that becomes, like Jesus Christ became Jesus Christ after he was, like he was revealing himself to the world, but like this was required a belief, right? It was not, it was like, did I see that? I did see that. This dude is special. Like we're all human, and how many of us recognize that the momentous thing is occurring when it's actually occurring, and how much of it is like, hindsight's 2020. I also love that, like, I don't know. I'm fond of the Judas character, because I think I had also never heard it phrased as like maybe he was a revolutionary, maybe he was like, the Malcolm X to Jesus's MLK, like that was really cool to have that position that way. But it also reminded me, I'm looking at my bookshelf, it's somewhere, I might have pulled it. I regularly reread Lamb by Christopher Moore. I don't know if you've read this, Ben, but you probably really enjoy it. Speaking of fiction, it's the gospel according to Jesus's childhood friend Biff. And it's a fictionalized telling of like essentially the time between the birth and his young childhood to the return to, preaching, and then his death. And the framing of Judas in that story is very, it garners something different. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. So basically, it starts with the angels being an angel being sent dirt side, as they called it, going to earth to resurrect another one to tell a new gospel. And they're like, it's like the human's like anniversary or something like that, is something big. And the angel's like, God damn it. Like, does not want to go. It's very irreverent. And then he, like pours the water on the ground and dust storm, and there's a man all dirty and naked, and he's like, how long has it been? And he's like, 2,000 years. And so he decks the angel, right? Because he's like, you bastard, you're late. So it's brilliant. It's really, really enjoyable read. I highly recommend it. I've given it to lots of people because I love this book. It was given to me by my best friend. And it's so like he does his work. I think that's the thing that I also appreciate about In the Shelter, is like this weaving, like it's that whole thing of, you know what it's about from the beginning. So it's not like, well, ta-da, and there we got it to this end of the end of the journey, and here's this conclusion that I'm making. It's very much like the weaving of a shelter together. Like, it's a very careful unpacking, the cyclical looping back to the cave and this idea of shelter and his fear, his name, the deconstruction of his name, that was like meaning tomb, and like, I mean, just his, like I said, his wordplay is so really enjoyable and exquisitely done and like open. Like, it's not, you have to be smart to understand it. You're like literally in the story and you learn something new about a word and its meaning, its multiple meanings. And I have a book where I'm using a bunch of words that are not translatable directly into English to like propel the poetry forward. And I did all this research. So I'm definitely like you're going to learn so much by just unpacking the word with him, mm-hmm. and like both the word lowercase, the words, but also the word, the word of Christ, which is heavily edited. Like, I keep coming back to that. Like, what? Yeah. You're just going to say it as like a holy man sort of. And this idea of being good. How did you feel about this idea of like, the purpose of faith, the purpose of is to grow, right? Didn't he say the purpose of faith is to grow, not to avoid punishment, but for its own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To want what you want, right? Not to want it for, and I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. It's almost like training wheels on a bike, right? At some point, you get rid of the training wheels of punishment and carrot and stick and reward and, you know, afterlife and all that. There is no old white dude bearded in the cloud that's going to send a lightning bolt down if you do the bad thing. You're supposed to want to grow on your own, I guess. Is what I took from, I can see the passage you're talking
right.
about. And it was almost like the real measure of growth is like that you maybe don't need that, like, you know, anthropomorphic God,
mm-hmm.
scary dude in the sky anymore. It's taking place on its own because it's what you want.
Yeah,
I thought that was so, you know, there's a passage in there on early that really shook me on as he's kind of like grappling with himself and who he is, and I think he's like in his teens, and he's aware, I think, that he's homosexual, but he doesn't necessarily, I don't think he's told a lot of people, but you know, it's kind of like he's almost like he knows it, but I don't know if he can even say it to himself. And he's talking about, again, I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, I'm just a man standing in my anger, you know, basically like wondering if it's okay to stand in my anger. And then the very next passage is a friend of his asking, you know, what's the thing you want most in the world? And he says, to be happy. And he says, what's the thing you want most in the world? And the friend says, well, I guess it'd be to be holy. And in his teenage mind, he goes, well, I guess I answered the wrong thing then, huh?
Yeah.
And he had to grow out of that, like, you know, holy to happy, like all that mess, how he kind of grows into that, like, you know, the spiritual, you know, path is, you know, ultimately to get happy enough with yourself that, you know, you can give to others, right? So
they're holy.
Right? So one is not necessarily exclusive the other, but to me it shook me, because to think that, like, and I'm 41 years old, you know, grown man, and I still, inner places where like it's not okay to be angry, right? Like, no, it's okay. Like, it's not okay to do some things, that are unacceptable because you're angry. But like, we have some of these kind of like Christian tropes where like some of these things are not okay. Like, it's not okay to be angry. It's not okay to be excessively sad. It's not okay to be not okay. Well, actually, like, if that's what you are, like, you need to stand in that, right? That needs to be okay. And so it was really powerful to me to see that, like, both that struggle, like, wanting to just stand in being an angry, confused, teenager, dealing with identity, but also, like, being able to say, like, I want to be happy more than anything else. Like, being made to feel wrong for that. Like, all that stuff in there was just a beautiful way to put, I think, a core contradiction between who we are and who we are made to be as people and this kind of institution that says what we should be.
I think the hardest part I had with the book, the hardest time I had with the book was like, I was like, you care a lot about people. And I care less about people. I'm really trying to keep my connection here. Just like, what did Maya Angelou say? She said something about like, not all people are trying to grow. Like, you got to seek out the people who are willing to change and grow and question, and listen. And, like I said, as a conflict mediator, mediate is not problem solve, like the idea is not to like get to a solution and have everybody agree. And I'm an absolutist a little bit sometimes, extremist maybe, in my thought. And I'm like, well, if we can't agree, then we're never going to save this world. Buddhism believes in this, like, in world peace through individual happiness. And I'm like, that's a nice idea. I've been practicing Buddhism for 20 plus years. And I'm like, it's a nice idea. It's hard to imagine that we're going to have like a sudden consciousness shift. And then things like, the pandemic happened and you're like, global change happened, whether for good or for bad, we all experienced something that changed us deeply. And then I'm like, and the results of what we'll do with that is very dependent on the person. See, people are trash. And it's a battle that I have with myself. And as I was reading, I was very much like noticing his compassion and his underlining of compassion as like the central theme, compassion for yourself. The need to hold differing and oppositional parts of yourself and other people and to not have to reconcile them. That's essentially the grace that he is talking about. To allow it to be both and I have a really hard time with that. Like I frankly, it was just like, this is taking the time to listen to people that I think are stupid because we're so like, we're so far away from each other's ideals. So like the example I have is like, I love my aunt and uncle very, very much. And they are like anti-vaxxers, Christians living in very rural Southern state. And I go there, I go visit because we go visit, knowing that we might be, that I'm like the blackest thing they've ever known. And also the queerest thing they've ever known. And now I have a child who is black and trans and wanting to be, called by his name and his pronouns. And God help them, they're trying. Bless their hearts. They really are. And I feel that effort of love. But it was like this summer sitting there in like triple digit heat, my uncle saying, like, I don't believe in climate change, but it's getting harder to deny it. And I was like, oh my God, like
awareness, this is a huge moment.
Awareness. The light, the crack through which the light creeps in, or whatever Leonard Cohen said. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Moment where it's like, oh my gosh, this is how it happens. This is how it happens. And, you know, it's like, God, it's such patient work. Mm-hmm. It's such patient work that you have to like undertake. And that was the thing. Ultimately, I was like, this is a patient storytelling, like to tell your story in this way. It's not just a story. It's not his memoir, but mm-hmm. it is. And it's not like a spiritual guidebook, but it is. And it's not, you know, like a series of essays or poems, but it's both. And yeah, it's like, it's a lot of things without needing to reconcile what it is. And that's, yeah, it was like a very liminal space for me to answer. Yeah. Just like, I gotta not resolve it. I don't.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, and your conclusion is okay, and your conclusion at the end of each chapter. So we're another hello.
I guess yep. We're saying hello again. Yeah.
There is no hello goodbye. Again. It's just hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the most beautiful, I thought, stories in the book is, you know, I forget where he is. But he's in this, I guess he's like holding dialogue between very conservative Christians and like the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after like several hours of conversation, this one like crotchety old guy, I'm assuming they're in Ireland, right? And this one like crotchety old guy who's on the very conservative Christian side asks, you know, how many times have my words bruised you today?
Yeah.
And it was this like really hard dialogue, like, oh, no, no big deal, whatever. And then he presses in like, no, 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 no. I want to know like how many times have my words bruised you? And the other person says, you know, I stopped counting after the first hour, right? It's like this honest, I wrote in like, you know, that part, like I wept reading that because mm-hmm. I thought back to like, you know, I don't know that anybody I'm close with has been curious enough to ask me like, have I hurt you like that, right? Like, and that's like my, you know, inner circle, right? But that's kind of the one-off story of somebody like getting really curious about how have I hurt you? How can I repair? I don't know if he's even asking how can I repair, but you can't ask that until you've asked how have I hurt you, right?
I think we've heard so many retellings and variations that one that, like, you know, when we're talking about Judas, like one that surprises us with a new perspective is nice. It's like, you know, a breath of fresh air. You're like, oh, I've never heard of Judas phrased that way, but we've heard all the stories. In fact, I would say unlike maybe, I mean, I don't know enough about other practices to know what their church looks like, but church is a retelling of the Bible stories over and over and reinterpretation of it's this mm-hmm. over and over and over again. That's what sermons are. They get a scripture and then they're like, okay, let me retell it to make a point that I'm making today. And so in the Christian tradition, this is like, it's, the retelling of it is just refreshing because it's so different from what you hear in church often, what you hear from other Christians. And it's really artfully done in a way that doesn't read like a sermon. And so you don't, and yet does, the same soothing mechanisms are there for sure. Those sort of incantations of hello this and hello that are very, very preachery. And also very poety, which is, you know, oral tradition, right? So like you have this sort of, but it's not this, like the holy text is not very holy. Everybody gets to touch the holy text, you know, it's not like the Torah or, you know, or the Quran or anything where it's like, this is, you know, like I can be a heathen and have a Bible, have several Bibles, study the Bible. Like it's been, it's been deconstructed and retold so many ways, in my opinion, that it doesn't hit the same. Like, I don't, that's why I'm like, oh yeah, the other place where I've seen something, a refreshing way of telling it, is in this fictional version, in which it's clear he did his homework, and his telling of, like, basically Jesus and Biff go off to meet the three wise men to learn from them, because Jesus is seeking enlightenment. That's his job. So he posits that the time he was gone, they like went to Egypt. People are like, there's no way you went to Egypt. He's like, bitch, I was there. It's great. You will very much enjoy this book. Because it's all very plausible based on the way he tells it and based on the research. It's from the Bible. It's very accurate. And oh my gosh, the Judas part of it is just, it's gorgeous. It's heartbreaking. It's Yeah, I won't ruin it, but you should definitely read it. You get to the point where you're like, I know how the story ends because it's Jesus.
Yeah.
But you're like hoping that it's going to, like, you actually, I had so much hope. I was like, but maybe they'll get away with it.
Yeah. It'll be differently.
Oh. It's really, 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 really well done. And that's what I think is great about In the Shelter, is that the stories are retold in a way and deconstructed in a way I've never experienced. Maybe people who grew up in the woo-woo, gay people accepting women ministers, you know, churches. Maybe they had good stories, but our stories are very, like, punishment focused or like praise focused, which is, you know, like, they were good because they followed God's rules, or they were punished because they were bad.
I can report back from the gay accepting women clergy church experience that every once in a while people would try like a more updated retelling. And sometimes it was really not well received by the more traditional people in the congregation. Like, there was once the pastor, he retold the story of the birth of Jesus. I grew up near the water in like a crabbing town. And he retold it as, instead of laying the baby in a manger, the baby was laid in a crab pot. And that was, he was not the pastor for very long after that story. So yeah, even among more like self-identified progressive Christians, I think there is, some people really cling to the text as like, this is what it means, and it can only mean this, and it is sacred in that way.
It's interesting too, like, culturally, we've been, you know, I've got two kids. We moved to a town in we're not quite the South, we're like middle Appalachia, right? Uh-huh. So we, you know, we found a women pastor. We're not quite gay accepting, but the church is splitting over that right now, and we're kind of going on one side of that, and the not gay accepting side is headed to a different direction. It's a church that doctrinally is founded very much on like text, or it's a denomination that's founded very much on like the scripture is one piece, but there's also like reason and nature and experience, and like all of that kind of forms into interpretation, you know, and how it plays out, right? So there's allegedly like there's a lot of leeway for, you know, interpretation of how things are in relationship with God, and how, you know, like there's not one set of rules that, you know, Deuteronomy says shellfish is an abomination because, you know, well, there it is in writing, right? Still, in the bigger culture of where we are, I just had this conversation with one of my kids the other day. Like, one of my kids has a huge hang up on like rapture and being left behind, and, you know, in being too lukewarm, right? If that was a phrase,
God will spit you out his mouth.
There you go, right? And I'm like, you are not getting that from our denomination. Like, that is not, you know, and it's like, that's the predominant culture where we are. it's so prevailing that like it's still seeping in. And so it's just interesting, like these are things. And like, so we're in the little town that my wife grew up in, and she grew up in a very different religious experience where it was, I mean, there was like stained glass of, you know, of the apocalypse in the back of the church. Like modern, right? So it was like, you know, dump trucks flipped over and fires and stuff. It was, get her to describe it sometimes.
Fresh out of the sky.
Yep.
Clothes left in pools, you know, yep. Pools of clothing where people just yep. got snatched up.
Snatched up.
Crashing right? into each other.
Yep. 100% that, yeah, she describes that, right? And it's hard to, because I didn't grow up with that, like my religious upbringing brought me up with, you know, some hangups around things, but like it's so hard for me to even put myself in the place of that, like all-encompassing fear of like, man, if I don't get my act right before I go to bed tonight, like
yeah,
what if, you know, what if shit goes off tonight, you know, like I, you know, and again, like that's not even, you know, the upbringing we're seeking right like now.
What if it's just the vision of the apocalypse? I'm sorry, I keep talking about the apocalypse, but I'm like, is it not happening? I grew up on the end days. That was the only movies we saw were like rapture films, because we yeah. were those kind of Christians for sure. You know, I have a blues song called Apocalypse Blues, and it's like, it's a slow slide, baby. Like this is it. And I think of like the motivation of fear, which I think Park talks about too in this book a lot, of like sometimes that is the ignition that gets the engine going. And these visions of like horrors and the, you know, waters running with blood and all these kind of like horrific things that end days prophecies are about. I mean, I'm like, what if that was, you know, you got to be good today because tomorrow might not come. And what if it's like fear of what happens if we don't do good today by like the way to not be left in the apocalypse is to like, be good today, be good every day, repent from your sins, turn from your ways. And repentance looks like, repentance is available to anyone and everyone at all times, but you have to mean it. Like, that's the thing. You have to be turning from your ways, or you have to be constantly begging forgiveness. And I remember being the kid who was like, did something bad and be like, Jesus, forgive me. Just in case. That was the moment, you know, might have been the moment. And, you know, as soon as I sinned, Jesus, forgive me, you know, like it was a thing. But like that motivation of fear is powerful. And I think that I'm like, what if your child is having like visions of apocalypse and is like, I don't want to be one of the ones left behind because I'm not paying attention. I don't know.
Oof. So it's like less, this is inevitable, and more just a, hey, if we don't collectively repent, or not repent, but like be better. Like
you gotta do better.
Yeah, right. We have to do better. Yeah.
And you gotta do better every day. It's not something where it's like, well, someday I'll give my heart. You know, like it's, there's so many songs about that in the church, because it's like, now is the time. Maybe, you yeah. know, it's a distortion of like, I don't know, Jesus is really about this earth, man.
Yeah.
That's an, that's a complicated conversation I had to have with my child recently too. Is like, as a human being, I can't tell you what happens like next, right? Like I can tell you what you know the doctrine is, I can tell you what, you know, is theologically prescribed, but like none of us has been there and come back right. and able to describe it. But I can tell you there's plenty of hell right here, and we make plenty of it on our own. If we work really hard and have a little bit of luck and, you know, we get glimpses of heaven, right? So focus on that, right? But also, there's this other thing where I find it fascinating that, like, and this is just a, this doesn't, some of this I think comes from the, can get tied back to the book when he's talking about, you know, being created in the image. But this has always kind of like fascinated me. Like, we're all, you know, in the story that the Bible tells us, right? The really the Torah, the first, you know, the first chapter says we're all created in the image, right? We all carry the image. And if that's true, then every single human being you meet has at least the potential, no matter how god awful they are, has the potential to live up to that, right? And yet we create this whole scheme of, you know, punishment to say, like, well, you know, this is bad and therefore eternal damnation, that's bad and therefore, you know, brimstone, you know, hellfire, etc. And I think, you know, God, there's enough punishment right here. Like,
do you really think most people would do good without the threat of punishment at this late stage of capitalism?
In my heart of
mongering, and you know what I mean? Like,
there's what I want to believe, right? What I want to believe is, yeah, absolutely.
I want
there's
to believe,
like, what I've seen. Oh, hell no.
No. Yeah. Like, same.
I mean, that's the dilemma, right? Like,
right. That is the
part of me that like wants this to not be a god awful shitty place. Wants to believe that, you know, the part of me that, like, you know, saw what happened in Iraq in 2006 and 2007 and knows that, like, you know, but for the grace of God, there go we, could be us tomorrow. Like, no, that.
Oh, what about that
rewards
moment?
And punishments.
Sorry, Ben, you just reminded me. What about that moment in the book where he's talking about the woman whose son is sick?
Uh-huh.
And gathers the prayer warriors to pray, and the son gets better and is about to testify in church, uh-huh, and say it was the faith of the prayer warriors, and there was the woman whose son did not get better despite the same prayers. And whoo, like, it reminded me very much, like, but for the grace of God, like, is it the grace of God, or is it just like pure luck, like lightning struck that, here and not there?
It's so important. He tells it twice.
Yeah.
But also, like, he says that woman still says the, like, thankful, she, you know, she changes her message a little bit, but she still has joy, even though she is sensitive to that other mother who it didn't, things went differently for. And that's something I think about a lot, is like, especially, you know, Ben, like you said, there's plenty of hell here on this planet. And like, how do you hold that reality in your mind, but also like experience your joy in ways that you can?
Yeah, I don't want to be like, I think that great change and great shift are inevitable. So why not a positive one? And I think that for a long time, we thought, you know, to your point, Ben, like that we were like maybe one step away from goodness. Like if we could just all just turn and go one step, if we could all gather hands across the globe and sing together, we are the world, then we could, you know, like, I think that we are in the last vestiges of clinging to that idea that we're not too bad. We're only one step away from like being a much better people. And I'm specifically talking about United States, like in our society, our culture as a whole, which is varied and multi-hued across the United States, right? So, you know, in our own little bubbles, none of our bubbles are bad. Like, I don't think that there's really actually like evil bubbles clustering across the United States where they're like, let's be evil together and destroy the earth. I think that they're like my family who you know, has their little parties and everybody gets in the pool with their beers and, you know, throw the cans back into the trash and burn this and do that. And they're good people. They're like just home enjoying themselves, right? Like there's not clusters of evil, I don't think, forming. I think it's the, you know, general tinge of us all, right? And, you know, things happen like global pandemics that take out a million plus people in a very short period of time. And I go, is that not a global shift? The earthquake happens and takes out tens of thousands of people at a time. And is that not a global shift? And I think the awakeness is the call of the book. And I'm asking this, I'm like trying to like, what is the point? What am I supposed to get from this? What is the call to action? But like this idea that all of it is for the purpose of holding the conflicting parts of yourself and the conflicting parts of everyone else, and not having to come to an agreement or a reconciliation, but hearing who they are and where they're at. Like, I wouldn't think of these people as my people if they weren't my blood. I wouldn't even know them. I would go out of my way to not encounter them. Same, vice versa. Like they would do.
Right.
I am not the person that they are seeking out in their lives. And yet, because of this, wasn't there some grace born? And who knows what the ripple effects will be? I won't be here to see them. And I think that's like, I don't know. I love the like magnitude and the smallitude. God is big and God is small. The big and the big and the small, and they spoon each other. That's the image that I got from that little piece, was like, God is the big and God is also the small, and they hold each other. And that was like, I saw big spoon, little spoon, and it's God, you know? I think of God, the shapeshifter. Like, I think of, you know, if we're all in the image of God and we're all so very different, then God shapeshifts to meet us. I love that idea of like the kid who goes to France and sees French people and who are like, well, who made them? Yeah, no, yeah. Who made the Protestants? They're bad. Like, what God was this? Whose work is this? It's very like that's the question. Like, who, you know, what God made this? And is it God-like? And God is a wishy-washy character, I feel. Like, Jesus is much more concrete in this book than this concept of God. And I think that was purposeful on Park's part. Like, I think that was really skillfully done.
The idea of sheltering in each other and people sheltering in community struck me with the mission of what CBAW does, what we're trying to do, what our workshops, the intention of them. And I was just thinking about that section, Hello to Story. And I love this quote, the past is the unfinished story that keeps us changing. I was listening to the audiobook and I had to rewind it multiple times to listen to that again. And just in the, you know, art workshops, writing workshops that we have each week, you know, people come and they write their story, but it's not over, right? Like, they come back to rewrite it as the context changes, as time continues to progress. I just thought that was a really powerful idea, the story that keeps us changing.
When I think of and or try to tell stories of the past, it's almost always with the framing of, and now I know better, or what I've learned, or, and from that I've drawn this conclusion, like I'm trying to do with this book, of like, what's the point? What's the story? What's the message I'm supposed to get? The investigation of my past leads me often, I'm like, I don't want that to be true about me, so I'm going to change it. Like, or I don't like what ended up happening because I behaved that way or because I made that choice or whatever. And so I'm going to change it. This, so the past is informing my decisions, hopefully towards the better, towards growth. But I think that's like a really elegant and simple way to put, like, essentially, if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. And so to get us out of the loop of just doing the same thing and being like, I'm good, I'm fine. Any investigation of your past goes, you know what? I think I'm going to change. I think I'm going to do differently. Or, you know, it's why we don't put our hand on the burner after we've done it once. Why we don't light the dumpster on fire after that one time playing with matches. And then you learn what happens when you throw them in the dumpster and you're like, won't be doing that again, you know, like those kind of things. It's how you learn. You fuck around and find out, right? So that's the story that keeps us changing is a prettier way of saying fuck around and find out, right?
Yeah. I think I like fuck around and find out more, but you know.
It's definitely more.
That's the radio edit. The radio version is this one.
I don't know. I think there's a generosity to it. Like for some, I mean, this can, you know, it's a careful line because it can be abused, right? But for some who carry things, you know, going back and revisiting the narrative can be an act of generosity towards the self. That can be necessary. That can be necessary, you know, as like the first act in opening up to becoming a better human, right? Like, I often the reason assholes are assholes, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, self-loathing and stuff there, right? So going back and finding a way to be, you know, generous or gracious to that which we're ashamed of, or that which we're not proud of, or that which, you know, we wish we had done differently, but being able to unpack it through story and go, okay, well, but I understand, you know, I understand me and how I got there and why I got there. Maybe I don't want to do that again, but I can let it go.
Yeah. If everyone was doing that, right? Like if everyone was engaging in that self-reflection,
yeah.
Then maybe we get closer to that world that we were all hoping for earlier, you know, where we are closer to good. But yeah, the idea of sheltering in the shelter of other people, yeah, where we live, that and idea. Yeah.
Story, not to just to riff on that, because what you said makes me think this, like story is inherently, you know, something that's done in pairs or more, right? Like it has to have a witness, a receiver, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like when done well, like there's a compassionate party there, right? That's helping you just hold that, you know, or that's receiving it and going like, all right, yeah, I hear that.
Being in community with people who are sharing with you gives you permission to share, to share back. And that's, yeah.
Well, the shelter you're finding with people is the shared story, right? I think of the woman who yelled in her baby's face and then his dissecting of audience and listening and, you know, like you need somebody to listen. So that's where I was going. I was like, wow, for good or for bad, a story requires audience to be a story. There needs to be a witness, and we find that witness. We find the sympathetic witness in shelter with other people, or we have people, yeah, who are willing to listen, even if they don't agree. And yeah, the things that bring us together happen, and you know, like that's when we go, we seek shelter. All to bring it back in a circle, like we seek shelter because we are afraid of what's happened, and we seek understanding through audience with other people.
Thanks for listening to this episode of CBAW Loves. A special thanks to our guests, Ben Weekly and Amber Flame. Next month, we're going to be reading Monstrillo by Gerardo Samano Cordova, which is I think our first fiction book, a novel that I really, really loved. As always, if you have anything to contribute to our conversation about In the Shelter or any of our books, please send us an email at cbawloves@cbaw.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
CBAW Loves is a community building artworks podcast produced by Amelia Bain with music by Rose Blakelock.
CBAW is committed to mission belonging, reconnecting veterans with their communities.
For more information, visit our website, www.cbaw.org.